From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. And now we're going to spend some time with Chef Jeff. You might be familiar with the name from his Food Network show, The Chef Jeff Project. Jeff Henderson is also a best-selling author and a motivational speaker. The award-winning chef first learned to cook while doing time in prison. His latest book is called America I Am, Pass It Down Cookbook. But it's as much a history book as a collection of recipes. The food and the family stories featured in the book explain how the history of African Americans, from slave traditions to Sunday suppers, influenced the way America eats today.
West African slaves brought okra seeds and watermelon seeds, you know, in their dreadlocks. And when they came here to America, they played a big role in farming and cultivation of vegetables here.
Though his name is on the cover, Chef Jeff said he wanted the cookbook to feel like something a community pulled together.
This is a book for the people, by the people. It's a community cookbook. And it was interesting how we found these folks. You know, we did a call through social media, and we asked people to turn in recipes that have been passed down from generation to generation. And this is how we came up with over 130 soul food recipes. Now, a lot...
You know, because not everybody gives up their recipes.
That's true.
You know, that's not easy to actually, you know, put a call out for recipes.
And, you know, that's a challenge we had in the African-American community, because I remember asking my grandfather before he passed away for the recipe for his gumbo. And he was like, boy, I don't have no recipe, better get in this kitchen and watch how I do it. You know, and we just don't document. And it's so important for us to start documenting history so we can tell our own story about, you know, many contributions that we make.
You know, I'd love to put together a meal, if we can, from the cookbook. I had a little idea, so just, you know, follow me on this.
Okay.
I'd love to serve up a recipe and the story behind the recipe, and I'm going to let you choose. Which one should we choose from the cookbook? We both have a copy right here in front of us.
I want to go to the gumbo. And gumbo was a big, big part of bringing the Henderson family together. We were coming up. So I choose the gumbo, you know, with rice and sausages, okra, crab, shrimp, and chicken as well.
Now, I asked you to serve up a story as well as the dish. What's the story behind the gumbo in this book? And even the word gumbo is interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, gumbo is I call it the Southern bouillabaisse. And it's amazing. I love to cook it. There's many great stories behind it as well. My grandfather was the main cook in our family, and he was the one who always cooked the gumbo for the family.
Are we serving biscuits with this meal?
Absolutely. Sweet potato biscuits.
Sweet potato biscuits.
Sweet potato
okay.
biscuits,
All
yes.
right. Put a little something in it.
Mm-hmm.
And do you use butter or lard in your biscuit?
Well, you know, there's two ways you can go about that. Butter is all about the flavor with the butter. Lard, you get a more flakier biscuit. I personally prefer butter in my biscuits.
Mm-hmm.
And with this particular biscuit here, you know, you can also take leftover candy yams, mashed sweet potato, and add to the biscuit. Because, you know, back in the day, you know, we didn't waste anything. You know, everything was used. The pot liquor left over from the collard greens, turn that into a soup, use it as a cooking liquid to boil vegetables or whatnot.
Now, we promised that these recipes would come with a story. And this one comes from a very interesting story. It's from Tuskegee, Alabama. And it appeared in How the Farmer Can Save His Sweet Potatoes and Ways of Preparing Them for the Table. And that was a book written by George Washington Carver, someone that we learn about every February in Black History Month, someone who contributed much to American agriculture.
Yes, and it would be amazing to find out that he cooked and had
what didn't he do?
As well. He done everything.
He
was
an
innovator, a renaissance man, wasn't he? Yes.
He did a little bit of everything. Now, for dessert, we've been waiting patiently to get to dessert because the studio smells so good
now. Well, you know, I brought some desserts here to NPR studio here today for you, Michelle.
And I've been trying. if I've been talking a little bit fast in the course of this interview,
That's
it's
okay.
because I've been eager to get to dessert because it looks so delicious.
Yes.
What did you bring in for us?
Well, we have a southern pecan pie, and we have a buttermilk pound cake.
Oh, but
with
some
blackberries.
You're not done because over behind me, and pardon me if
I
reach
you know,
for
I was
going to
save the best for last.
We have a big old basket
yes.
here. What's in this?
We have some red velvet cupcakes. Yes, with cream cheese whipped on the top there. Amazing, great, moist, wonderful flavor. You going to have a bite with me?
I am going to have a bite with you. Now, the red velvet cupcake has had a renaissance. You can find them. Sorry if I'm talking and chewing at the same time, but you can find them all over the place. This was really a southern treat for many, many years.
Yes. And
people didn't always use food dye.
They didn't. They used to use red beets and vinegar. I don't use vinegar in mine. I just don't like the vinegar taste.
Mm-hmm.
I actually use food coloring versus the beets because we wanted to make this Pass It Down cookbook recipes very simple for the home cook. So we didn't make it too complex. But there's many people make it many, many different ways.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
What do you want people to do with this cookbook?
I want people to understand the stories and the connection that African-Americans played in history in this country and food. I want people to document and save the recipes that came from their family from generation to generation.
And you have a place for them to do that.
Absolutely, right in the back of the book. And that was one of the most amazing additives to this book. Is this book stays in the kitchen. It should never leave the kitchen. It should be in the kitchen for hundreds of years, because whoever comes along and open this book, there's recipes in the back, and they can document themselves.
Chef Jeff, always good to talk to you.
Likewise.
That was Chef Jeff Henderson. His latest book is called America I Am, Pass It Down Cookbook, over 130 soul-filled recipes. And you can find a few of those soul-filled recipes at npr.org.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. He's considered a hero by many conservatives, but politicos from across the spectrum will mark what would have been Ronald Wilson Reagan's 100th birthday this weekend. We'll talk about his legacy with particular focus on his relationship to minorities. That conversation is coming up. But first to our Faith Matters conversation, where we talk about matters of faith and spirituality. And just yesterday at the National Prayer Breakfast, President Obama opened up about his faith. Every president has attended every year since the event began in 1953. But President Obama surprised some faith leaders with his unusually personal tone.
My earliest inspirations for a life of service ended up being the faith leaders of the Civil Rights Movement. And there was, of course, Martin Luther King and the Baptist leaders, the ways in which they helped those who had been subjugated to make a way out of no way.
And President Obama went on to say he found his faith when he was working as a community organizer in Chicago.
And it was through that experience, working with pastors and lay people, trying to heal the wounds of hurting neighborhoods, that I came to know Jesus Christ for myself.
We wanted to get some perspective on the president's speech, so we've invited the Reverend Jim Wallace back to the program. He was also there. He's the founder and president of the organization Sojourners. That's a Christian group focused on social change. Reverend Wallace, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Michelle, always great to be with you. This is a great show. I love to be on it.
Well, thank you. You wrote a blog post about the president's speech, and one of the questions that I had is, I was wondering whether you were in a way gently chastising him, because you talked about how in this speech he talked a very great deal about the poor, and he talked a very great deal about his own personal faith walk, which is not something that he has discussed in a number of other places, most notably in the State of the Union. So in a way, were you gently prodding the president on this point?
Well, as you know, I've known him for a long time, and the speech reminded me of the conversations we used to have. But I did notice these two things. One is he was personal and knowledgeable about faith, so his fierce critics who challenge his faith and question his faith would have a hard time after hearing yesterday. He wanted to walk closer with God and make sure that walk is my first and most important task. He said, I wait upon the Lord every morning and every night, and it was very personal. At the same time, as you suggested, I noticed he spoke about the poor or the vulnerable 12 times. So it's almost as he got closer to his faith, he got closer to the poor, which I think makes sense. But that was much more of a kind of a overt conversation about poverty than we heard in the State of the Union or we often hear from the White House.
Do you feel that it, in part this was strategic, in part to answer these critics who have raised questions, continue to raise questions about whether the president is really a Christian after all?
Well, he even implied, I think, Michelle, that he and Michelle, his wife, First Lady, had been hurt by these accusations. I felt a little of that yesterday. But he responded by not defending so much as by affirming, this is my faith. And he is a person of faith. And in this case, the president does know faith, and it's very personal. And he knows of what he speaks.
And finally, before we let you go, would you just tell us a little bit about the National Prayer Breakfast? It's kind of an odd event in some ways. It's not held in a church. It's held in a hotel ballroom. It was organized by kind of a private quasi-religious organization. It dates back to the Eisenhower era. What is this event, and why do you think it's important?
Well, it's sort of a time to where people want to acknowledge the importance of prayer or faith. Now, it can be kind of a civil religion, civic faith, kind of common denominator thing, or it can be much too sectarian, where some people feel left out of it. I remember my favorite ones are when Bono spoke at the prayer breakfast and talked about every faith tradition calls us to stand with those who are left out, left behind. I remember Senator Mark Hatfield spoke years ago when I was in seminary, and he called the war in Vietnam a national sin and shame in front of Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger. I saw their faces, and they weren't happy with that. So when it can raise up issues that we ought to be accountable to, whether we are religious or not, I think that's when it's probably at its best.
Reverend Jim Wallace is the founder and president of the organization Sojourners. That's a Christian group that's focused on social change. His latest book is Rediscovering Values, A Guide for Economic and Moral Recovery. And maybe you'll come back and talk with us about that one.
Love to, Michelle.
Reverend Wallace, thanks so much for joining us.
God bless.
The TV audience for the Super Bowl is huge. For last year's game, it was estimated to be 106,500,000 people. That makes the Super Bowl an enormous opportunity for an advertiser in search of impressionable eyeballs. Well, Harper's Magazine put that fact together with widespread hostility toward the federal government, and it came up with this project: compose a hypothetical Super Bowl commercial for Uncle Sam, a commercial to revive a suspect brand, the federal government. The magazine brought in four creative types from big advertising agencies and sat them down to brainstorm. Joining us is Harper's columnist and author Thomas Frank.
How are you today, Robert?
And one of the brainstormers, Mark Fitzloff, an executive director at the advertising agency Wyden & Kennedy in Portland, Oregon, joins us. Welcome to you.
Hello. Thank you.
And first, Thomas Frank, tell us about the notion of devising a commercial for the federal government.
One of the criticisms of Washington that you hear all the time is that if only the federal government was run more like a business, then it wouldn't be so awful and so dreadful. Well, we thought about it. One of the things that the federal government would do if it was run by like a business is it would advertise. It wouldn't let its brand get run down in the way that, I mean, the federal government is uniquely unpopular.
Well, Mark Fitzloff, tell us about some of the ideas that you and your fellow ad men tossed around and tossed out.
Well, I think our inclination was that you had to treat the government with a little bit more respect. You know, obviously, comedy is a favorite tool for Super Bowl commercials. But our hunch was that as the brand that you're representing gets more important in people's lives, then the value of comedy probably goes down. So if you're making an advertisement for deodorant, by all means, joke away. But if you're making an advertisement for the federal government, maybe that's not the time or place. Now, saying that, of course, as soon as we went back to our corners to actually come up with Super Bowl ideas, we threw all of that theory away. And we just kind of went for it, and we created the halftime special sponsored by the federal government. And so we have Stephen Colbert hosting the halftime show, and what he is setting out to do is, during the course of the halftime special, watch the approval ratings go from the crapper to the top of our little meter.
Your meter has some interesting levels, levels of public attitude toward the government.
There's obvious ones like Man on the Moon, and then some slightly tongue-in-cheek sarcastic ones like Mission Accomplished. The kind of ultimate is the Queen Mother herself, Oprah, coming out and rewarding everyone with free cars, which is all you really need to shoot the approval ratings up.
Now, each of the four agencies involved here came up with an idea. And Tom Frank, there's one I'd like you to describe, which is the one in which you see somebody painting a mustache on a big mural of Chairman Mao, and later somebody throws a pie in the face of Adolf Hitler while he's giving a speech, and someone streaks past President Ahmadinejad of Iran, who's there with the Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei. On the screen at the end of that spot, can you read what they say?
This is supposed to be a voiceover, but it says, "Wherever they live, people can speak their minds, but there are very few places they can actually get away with it."
Mark Fitzloff, you remark that being confronted with a Super Bowl ad campaign is not always the best thing that happens to you in your work as a creative director in advertising.
No, it just raises the stakes and the pressure on what one is hoping to accomplish with the advertising. So it gets into your head as a creative person to think, well, Where is my explosions? Where are my dancing animals, et cetera, et cetera? So none of that leads to good, honest, authentic communication, which I think in the case of the federal government's problem is absolutely what's needed. And I think actually the best case of advertising I've seen for the government recently is their decision to cross the aisles and sit together at the State of the Union address.
Let's imagine for a moment that Harper's had no tongue in its cheek when it set out doing this. Why isn't this a realistic proposition to have a Super Bowl campaign for the federal government?
Well, it sounds like a great idea when you describe it in some of the ways that we've been describing it. But like everything else here in Washington, it would be considered partisan.
And as the creative person who'd be charged with that, I think the most difficult assignment would be to make this nonpartisan, because that piece of communication doesn't exist. Everything would be misconstrued. There would be meaning found in every decision that you make that's some sort of commentary from one side or the other.
Can you imagine the fights they'd have over it?
That's a creative's nightmare as far as the clients go.
Mark Fitzloff, can you imagine a more difficult client to work for than the federal government?
I cannot imagine a more difficult assignment. And my outlook and prognosis would be grim if I had this assignment really plopped into my lap.
Mark Fitzloff of Wyden & Kennedy in Portland, Oregon, and Thomas Frank of Harper's Magazine, both of whom participated in Harper's project to compose a Super Bowl spot for the federal government. Thanks to both of you for talking with us.
Sure thing.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And by the way, the group came up with two more Super Bowl ads for Uncle Sam. One proclaims, "Our government is a lot like ice cream. Little children try to reach consensus, choosing vanilla over chocolate." And the other features the actor Robert Downey Jr. standing on Mount Rushmore saying, "Only in America can a beloved, handsome movie star stand atop a national monument."
More coming up from All Things Considered. Super Bowl 45 will be played on Sunday in Dallas. The game matches two of the National Football League's flagship franchises, the Green Bay Packers and the Pittsburgh Steelers. Sports writer Stefan Fatsis joins us now, as he does most Fridays, to talk about this game. And Stefan, it seems like the NFL couldn't ask for much more. You've got these two legendary teams. They've both got passionate fan bases. They're playing for a championship. Dallas even managed to have some snow on the ground for them to make them
feel
home.
Yeah, that's a good way of looking at it, too. They've imported some snow to honor these teams, which, by the way, have 18 NFL titles between them, a Super Bowl and pre-Super Bowl. The Packers were founded in 1919 by Curly Lambeau. They were named for a local meat packer, the Indian Packing Company. The Steelers joined the NFL in 1933. The boxing promoter Art Rooney paid $2,500 for a team. And now, in modern times, and this is not something you're going to hear a lot about this week, is that neither of these ownerships probably should even be running their teams. The Packers are the only community-owned franchise in major pro sports. They went public to avoid a collapse in 1949, nearly folded in the late 1950s, and then Vince Lombardi came to town and they went on this great championship run. The Rooney family is still in control, largely because though it had fallen out of compliance with ownership rules in the NFL as more of the billionaires came into the league, the NFL's league office really pushed bankers a couple of years ago to cut a deal to make sure this family stayed.
Now, Stefan, the other backdrop for the game is the state of labor negotiations between the NFL's team owners and the players' union. Is that somehow seeping into Super Bowl week?
Pretty much in reporters' questions constantly. The NFL Players Association's head, Demoris Smith, held a news conference yesterday. He was very stern. He threatened to decertify the union if the owners, as many are predicting, lock out the players when the contract, labor contract, expires on March 4th. He said the players oppose an 18-game season, which is what the owners want, up from 16 games now, because of the risk of more injuries. The NFL's commissioner, Roger Goodell, held his annual State of the League news conference today. He defended the push for an 18-game season as fan-driven. He also said March 4th is a key date because of what might happen afterward. It was kind of a general warning. He didn't use the word lockout. In any event, Goodell stressed the need for bargaining, and there is an actual session between the two sides scheduled for tomorrow.
Stefan, let's look ahead to the game. The Steelers have won more in the regular season, but they're not even considered to be the favorite here. Help us understand that.
Well, the Steelers had a 12-4 record in the regular season, then two playoff wins. The Packers snuck into the playoffs at 10-6. They were the lowest seed in the National Conference. They've won three playoff games. And all six of the Packers' losses have been by 4 points or fewer. And according to the website Cold Hard Football Facts, only seven teams have gone an entire season in the Super Bowl era losing no games by more than 4 points. And those teams had 0, 1, 2, or 3 losses. These two teams, the Packers and Steelers, are very evenly matched, very similar, big mobile quarterbacks that like to pass, erratic rushing games, very similar defensive alignments that blitz a lot.
What about the coaching matchup?
Well, you've got on the one side Mike Tomlin of the Pittsburgh Steelers, the third youngest head coach in any pro sport, major pro sport. He's still in his 30s. He's already got one Super Bowl victory under his belt in 2009. He's gone for a second Super Bowl in 3 years. First time that's ever happened for someone this young. On the Packers, you've got Mike McCarthy. You're not going to get much out of either of these guys. They're not the most dynamic interview-type personalities, very sort of straightforward, serious faces on the sidelines you'll see during the game.
And this late in the season, injuries can always be a factor, and I guess you're going to see that on Sunday.
Absolutely. There was a big one today that was announced. It was a guy that plays a position that doesn't get talked about very much, center. The Steelers center, Maurkice Pouncey, had suffered a complete tear almost of a ligament in his ankle. Today he was ruled out of the game. So he's going to be replaced by Doug Ligursky. This guy's going to be starting his first ever game in the National Football League. So good luck in your first game, Doug.
Can you imagine that your first game is the Super Bowl?
I mean, imagine what this guy's going through.
I mean, I can't even imagine that kind of pressure.
I mean, a lot of pressure here to get that snap back to the quarterback, Ben Roethlisberger, and whether the Packers will certainly try to exploit that.
Stefan, have a great weekend.
You too, Michelle.
That's Stefan Fatsis as he joins us most Fridays. He's the author of A Few Seconds of Panic, a sports writer plays in the NFL.